Voice Alliance International Podcast.
I don't make this stuff up.
You know, if you put Jesus Christ first, that he'll look after all your bills.
It's not fake. It's faith.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Atheist Alliance International Podcast. I'm your host, Jason. Just before we get started, I would like to remind everybody to please hit the like and subscribe button. Joining us today is Professor Joe Blankholm from the University of California, Santa Barbara, who is his areas of are American religion, secularism, and atheism. He's done some pretty interesting surveys. Just read off his profile here. He's fielded the largest survey ever of organized non-believers in the U.S. and is currently working on essays dealing based on the survey data and the secular Felix. So welcome, Joe. Thank you for joining us today. And maybe you could just give us a quick introduction to the research that you've been doing and your findings.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I do kind of a wide range of research. It's one of the benefits, I'd say, of being a person who studies atheism in a religious studies department. It's a department that's really organized by its subject matter, and you can, in fact, study the antithesis of the subject matter. But because of that, it allows a lot of methodological range. And so I'm able to do philosophical inquiry and do historical work that's sometimes based in archives. Also do ethnography. I'd say that's my primary training as an ethnographer. So participant observation and interviews with people. And then more recently, I've started doing more survey work. I've had to retrain. Perhaps those who've done that mid-career will have some sympathy for me. It's a little time consuming to pick up another authorial voice and use evidence in different ways. So I have a couple of surveys. One is the secular community survey that we filled in a couple of years ago. That has 12,370 very secular respondents. Our screener question was, anyone who's ever been on a mailing list or joined a group in any kind of way that is specifically for non-believers? And respondents are restricted to the United States. So that's only US respondents. And then I have another survey that's called the Longitudinal Study of Generations. That's a continuation of a study that began in 1970 that's been tracking more than 350 of families that were originally identified in California, but now spread throughout the country. And then as a subset of those people, I've interviewed 189 of them. And for 20 families, we have three generations. So children, parents, and grandparents giving perspectives on each other, on religion, on non-religion. And that's a fairly non-religious sample, I think in part because it was originally sampled in California. California demographically tends to be kind of the bleeding edge of the United States. So you can see what the US is likely to become in about 10 years by looking at religious demographics in the state of California. So it's a fairly, I would say, religiously unaffiliated sample. What people are actually up to is kind of all over the place within that. So recently, mainly trying to publish things out of the secular community survey and doing more mixed methods, how to argue with quantitative evidence that appeals more to some audiences, but also do qualitative work that allows you to get into the nuances and really pay attention to what people are saying and thinking. And then also thinking more about this longitudinal study of generations, which I'll start writing a book based on that work next year. My earlier work that I think I'm here mostly to talk about is a book I published last year called The Secular Paradox on the Religiosity of the Non-Religious. That's really an ethnographic book that's informed by history and philosophy and really focuses on very secular people in the United States. So you can kind of see my work is expanding from that focus on more explicitly like non-believers and secular people now into I'm really interested in the variety among the non-religious, but I also interview and think about evangelical Christians and Muslims and Jewish Americans and a wide range of people.
So I've seen it before. It's probably fair to say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the U.S. is kind of considered the outlier amongst sort of Western industrialized countries in its religiosity, whereas you see like most of the European countries, they're highly irreligious, but the U.S. kind of has this. And I think it's only been in the last year or two that the percent of evangelicals has actually dropped below 50% in the last year or two. So, and we've seen the explosion of the nuns in the U.S. Getting upwards of approximately about 30% of the population now. So is that a fair assessment that gels with what your research is showing?
So I think of it as the U.S. is on a different timeline. There's a great article by Mark Chaves and David Vose published a few years ago now. The exact date is maybe 2019. And in that essay, they show that the U.S. is observing the same trends, but just not on a delay, basically. And that's a big change, because I think that prior to their demographic work and the demographic work of some other people, it seemed like the U.S. was an exception. But in that larger context, that sort of retrospect we now have, basically, we can see that the U.S. was in sort of a holding pattern during the Cold War. So the percentage of religiously unaffiliated remained about the same for the 40 years from about 1950 to 1990. And if we look back even further now, we can see that the 50s are probably the most religious the United States has ever been. And so when we started at that point, we thought, oh, this is all decline. But if you take a broader historical perspective, you realize it's kind of difficult to church people. You got to convince a lot of people to go to church on Sunday, to believe certain things. That process took a long time. And then now during the Cold War, like, people were really advocating for Christianity domestically and abroad. And so that was an attempt to oppose godless communism ideologically and really align a certain form of hyper-individualist Christianity with capitalist values. And they did a fairly good job of that. And so starting at the end of the Cold War into the 90s, religious non-affiliation, which is just one measure of religiosity, we should say. So, like, I think of religion simply as belief, behavior, and belonging. The people who don't belong or self-describe as being part of a religion, a lot of them still pray and believe in a higher power or even believe in a personal God. But so if we're just looking at that measure of belonging, which is an important one, absolutely. So that goes from 7% to 14% through the 1990s. And then that's been steadily increasing. So now we're at about a third of Americans have no religious affiliation as of like 2022, 2023. And that's probably going to rise. And so we're getting much closer to Europe. And I think we can assume there's going to be some kind of plateau. But what I'm seeing in my research and what I'm really fascinated by is the old ways that we use to measure things, they're breaking down. And you can kind of see that with the religiously unaffiliated measure, where if you in 1975 are asking Americans about their religious affiliation, people are largely sorting themselves according to that question. If a third of the people are no longer responding to the options of the question, you've got a broken category. And I think we see that kind of across the board. So even now, this is so the last time I checked the general social survey, there's more than 7% of atheists say they believe in some form of God. And so I think that, you know, if I talk to people ethnographically, right, I have people say to me straight up, they're like, well, if by God you mean nature, yeah, sure, I believe in God. And so I think we're also seeing people be less oriented by Christianity, and they're just expanding what they mean personally by some of the terms that we're still using on surveys. And so I think what that tells me too is that there's probably more non-religiosity that doesn't really look like Christianity than we're even accounting for, because people are still kind of they're starting to use the old terms in new ways that we're not keeping up with. So I think you're right that the U.S. is different from Europe. That's objectively the case. But I think we're kind of catching up in a way. And, you know, whether that changes is really hard to say. Pew does this really cool work where they project across the globe based on birth rates and religiosity of people in all different kinds of places. And so it looks like religion, I mean, from a pure demographic perspective, is going to be an even bigger deal in 100 years, but in 30 years too. So, you know, what kind of trends we're looking at on a global level, I think it's also important to provincialize Europe and the United States when we think about that.
Yeah, I agree with your point about the survey questions. I've seen that, you know, AAI being a global organization, you know, we see campaigns in countries around the world about updating those kind of survey questions to reflect what's really going on, because as you said, like, if the option isn't there for people to ticket, so it's definitely something we're seeing campaigns in multiple countries, and some countries have already succeeded in having the questions changed on their surveys. So it's an interesting point. So when you say the paradox of the religiosity of the non-religious, is this is kind of what you mean by, like, there's people who claim to be atheists, but they're still spiritual, or they believe in something. Is that what you're referring to?
No, I kind of mean something deeper and more troubling, truly paradoxical. So that book is really arguing that when we talk about even secular lives, we have to do so under Christian conditions. I speak English as my primary language. It's the language that I grew up natively speaking. I arrive in that situation midstream. I didn't invent that language. I had to learn its concepts, its vocabulary, in order to express myself. And that really sets the table in a certain way. And that's true for really pretty much any language. I don't think we have a secular Esperanto. And so we're going to be thinking through languages in which what we also think of as religion, which has its own history, is already kind of set the stage. And so if we just think about English and Christianity, and we think about the predominance of Christian culture, let's say in North America, but to a degree also Europe, Christianity is the unmarked background. People aren't thinking without Christianity just because they're no longer Christian. They're very much still thinking through its categories. So that situation is kind of a contradictory one if you're secular. So what I do is I think about how that affects people on an everyday level. And so, like myself, I'm a secular person. I guess you might say I'm an atheist. It gets really hard when you get to like the history of all these terms. But I think it makes sense. Like what most people mean by atheist, what most people mean by agnostic, that's me. I'm like a secular person. So I just want to say I include myself in this. So sometimes I'll say they or something like that, but hey, it's all of us. And so when we're looking at people who are very secular in the United States, there's this interesting thing where, like, you know, I was at this secular Dia de los Muertos event in Los Angeles a few years ago. And there's a woman, she said, you know, we're secular, but we're human. And what I took by that, such a profound phrase, is she's saying, like, we still need to mark time in our lives. And we can do that through ritual. And we can do that through, I mean, if you're talking basically like weddings and memorial services, it's hard to do without those things. But people also do like coming of age ceremonies, naming ceremonies. And you can see I'm kind of abstracting in some ways what we think of as Christian rituals of, like, say, confirmation or christenings. And so ways to mark time in life, secular people can want those too. Also, secular people might be like-minded and want to get together with other people who share their perspective. I've done some research kind of way back when now that tracked all the local non-believer communities in the United States and found that they're more likely to appear in counties, U.S. counties, where there are more evangelical Christians. And so it seems like people want to be around like-minded people more when they kind of feel embattled. But you start forming communities with other non-believers, that is kind of like congregations by default. So people will want to distance themselves from that, say, oh, well, we're just drinking skeptically. We're only going to meet up once a month in bars. We're not really going to have a leader because we're wary of authority or groupthink. But then I talk to, you know, some people who are ex-evangelical ministers who are going around the country doing kind of important work, talking to these communities, but they can't get any funds to support what they're doing like they used to be able to do when they were evangelical preachers, because secular people don't really want to do anything that looks like tithing, and they don't really want to support an authority figure. And so there's this push and this pull, and I think of it as kind of a pendulum. So if you are really secular and you're really secular under Christian conditions, and you have, you know, really a worldview, a way of thinking that science is the best way of knowing the world, the senses or things that enhance the senses like technology are the best way to find truth. It's not going to be through mysticism. It's not going to be through revelation. It's not going to be through scripture. It's not going to be these other ways. It's going to be this particular set of ways. And you think death is the final end. I mean, maybe my molecules will get reabsorbed into nature, but I don't believe in reincarnation. I don't believe in an afterlife. So if I want to be around other people who share these things with me, and maybe I'm even getting into communities, I want somebody who's kind of like clergy to be there when I die or my family member dies so that I can have a memorial service without God talk. I want someone to be able to marry me that understands where I'm coming from and can create rituals that are meaningful for me as someone who thinks this is my only life. If I have those things, I'm getting too close to religion all the time. It's kind of this specter that hangs over us. And so to live in religion's remainder is to live a small life. And how do you deal with that? How do you always try to avoid religion and then have it be the shadow that determines, in fact, what you can't be? Or how do you embrace it and then become too much like the thing that you're not supposed to be? And in the process of doing all that work, what I figured out was when you're secular, you actually are part of a tradition and you can trace it. And it has like ways of feeling and attitudes toward the world. So if I'm looking at like in 1800s, there's this woman, Almina Slinker, and she writes this beautiful children's book. And there's this section where she helps children understand like how to come to terms with death. And she does that by talking about her own daughter's death. And so she lives in a world that has, you know, she doesn't think she's ever going to see her daughter again. She thinks when she dies, that's the end for her. And she's trying to help other secular people explain this to their children in the 1800s. So we're a part of a tradition that's been around for a while, especially if you start to trace the elements of it. But because we're within this larger Christian culture, in this context in North America, for instance, or in Europe, we're always seen as not religion. That's the paradox. It's this contradiction within the inheritance in which we share ideas with other people, beliefs about the world, attitudes about how best to know the world. We end up reinventing the wheel in terms of rituals. We end up kind of doing these things over and over again because we don't want to attach ourselves to institutions that's too religious. But because we do it under Christian conditions and because Christianity has long considered that particular set of beliefs to be its atheism, then we cannot be religious. That's a paradox, a contradiction within inheritance. That's So that's really what the book is about.
And I'm sure you heard, and many of our viewers have probably, we've read articles about like there's atheist churches in certain communities where people get together on Sunday mornings and sort of have that spirit of community. And you mentioned it was interesting about how that the secular communities really seem to cohere in strongly evangelical communities. So I presume that's because that's in reaction to their living in such a highly religious environment. These secularists come together in those environments sort of as a tribal cohesion. Would that be your understanding of why they're strong in those communities?
I think they come together more, they form communities more frequently, and they form more communities in areas where there are more evangelicals, but they also form communities like in New York. Like the ethical culture movements existed since 1876, and they have a beautiful building at 64th and Central Park West. And so And Auguste Comte's Religion of Humanity was hugely influential in France and continues to influence. I mean, it's on the motto is on the Brazilian flag, actually, order and progress. And so there's a really wide range of places and times when people have gotten together in these very secular ways, and which also look like religious ways, right? But yeah, so in those areas where people are forming these communities, we could think of it maybe as tribal. I think that there's, I mean, Atheist Alliance International, right? There's like people coming together because they share certain things. And I think if you are atheist or you're secular, it's hard to talk about what you share because you want to talk about actually all you share is what other people don't, like you lack. That's all you share is what you lack. But if you dig into it, that's not really true. There's actually specific things that are shared. So I actually am doing some recent work. There's an article that I've been working on with some colleagues where we look through the general social survey, which is really the gold standard of survey data on the United States. And we're trying to identify like, what are the beliefs of non-believers? So how do you do that, right? You find questions in other parts of the survey that are really kind of belief, fundamental belief-oriented questions, like philosophers, what they might consider beliefs, like epistemology, ontology, what's real, how best to know the world. So we found some of those questions. And then we went and saw like, you know, we expect there to be an empiricist epistemology and maybe like an ontological materialism and for people to think that death is the final end. If we go look for that, do we find that people who call themselves atheist agnostic, are they likely to hold those beliefs? And are people who hold those beliefs, are they likely to be atheist and agnostic? We found that's actually completely the case. They're very likely. And so there's a shared set of beliefs there, but we can't really talk about that. And so it's not just that people are maybe like forming something we might call tribes. And it's good to watch our language there because we can see kind of like, we're saying like, ah, that's some kind of like previous point in human history. Maybe that's a behavior pattern that we've overcome through the Enlightenment or something like that. Really people are just like, man, there's a lot of billboards in my area that are promoting a lot of Jesus-oriented cosmology. Are there other people like me who are trying to raise their kids, who are trying to be in some other kind of community than the one that predominates in my area? They're absolutely forming those communities. But I think like, you know, all of us in some ways are looking. You have this privilege if you're in Europe. I think of it as like, you know, if you're walking a secular path and it's just like you in the woods, and you run into somebody and you see somebody else on it, you might be like, wow, hi, you know, you might greet that person. But if you're in a city and that everybody's on that path and you're going down a boulevard, you don't have time to greet others. You don't see the point. Everyone around you is secular. And so there's kind of a privilege of indifference that a lot of Europeans and Americans in urban areas are allowed. And so maybe we still want to connect in these more diffuse groups like Atheist International or something like that. Although I think obviously there's a really variegated mission there where like it's partly people in certain areas in the world where they might also be a minority or even persecuted or prosecuted for blasphemy and be in real danger. And so there's different ways that people are seeking community, but it's all under these conditions in which we imagine ourselves to only share what we lack, but then in fact share this thing that we're not supposed to acknowledge, which is something deeper.
Yeah, and people are seeking meaning, they're seeking connection, they're seeking community. So, yeah, okay. So you're doing another survey as well, according to your profile, right, on secularism in the US, correct?
Yeah, the Secular Community Survey, that one was really, so that's already been fielded, we've been analyzing it. It's an interesting data set. It's got issues when you're trying to measure certain things because it's very homogeneous. So that there's so much agreement among very secular people in the United States that you have to tease out their subtle differences. And some of our questions we thought would be good at doing that and they're not. And some of them are actually quite good at it. And so, yeah, that survey, we're trying to understand, you know, is there a difference between people who get into secular communities face to face versus who are just, say, on a mailing list of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? That question in particular, where we expected to see some differences, there's not much difference. We find that, like, some of the only differences are people who are joining local secular communities to meet together face to face as non-believers. They're generally more open to participating in some kind of secular ritual. And that could be a secular Dia de los Muertos event. That could be a secular memorial service. That's all we really mean by it. They're slightly more interested in that. And also they're generally just like more receptive to the idea of ritual. So they might have created their own secular ritual as well. They're more likely to do that. There's very little else that it predicts. I was kind of shocked, honestly. And so we're trying to answer some of those questions and we're still digging into the data. And unfortunately we had some staff turnover. So some of the folks that were working on some of these questions ended up having to leave the project. And so we're still digging into some of that. But yeah, that survey, some of the essays I'm interested that are close to finish for that one. This might be interesting to some of your audience. So there's a philosophical tradition called atheology. You spell it A/theology. And that tradition is largely an atheistic tradition. There are some people who are Christian who work in it too, but a lot of the people who work in it are secular. But what they work on as philosophers is how a lot of the ideas that we consider secular, you can see versions of them like within Christianity or within Judaism, but you have to just be like, well, I agree on 99% of things, and then I take God out because I kind of mean by something else by God. So for instance, there's a wonderful philosopher of religion, that's a colleague in my department named Tom Carlson. And he works in part on like, what's the influence of St. Augustine on Heidegger? Heidegger's very secular, very atheistic in some ways. I don't think he would maybe use that word to describe himself, but how much influence does he have with like one of the church fathers, so St. Augustine. And so atheology is really looking at post-Christian secular people, which is, I think, a lot of us, because right, if we're speaking in English and we're still thinking through these categories, we're shaped by this thing, Christianity, but we're not Christian. And so we've actually found really interesting ways to show in the data from that survey that the hypotheses of atheologians that they are arguing from through philosophical evidence, which is usually quite different, we can support with the survey. So that essay I hope to be done with pretty soon. I think that'll be a fun one. And there's some other ones too. So we're just thinking about how can we use this data to make some interesting arguments that maybe other people haven't made yet. And there's a wonderful demographer named Ryan Burge, and I saw that he has some funding to do a survey kind of like ours, but probably bigger in scale. That's not just focused on people who've ever even been a part of a mailing list or something like that, but it's just like everyday secular people in the United States. And I'm really curious to see what he comes up with, because he's a very talented demographer who's good at like large scale quantitative analysis.
Okay. If you're kind of reminding me of something here. I don't know how familiar you are with, or if you've heard of, Jordan Peterson. So some scholars I've talked to had never heard of him. Some have heard of him and have nothing nice to say about him. He makes in his biblical series in 2017, he makes the claim, like as you mentioned, you know, we're all a product sort of, you know, of growing up in a Western culture that is based on a Judeo-Christian ethic. Which is kind of the point you're making. So just curious, I mean, have you come across any of his work and have any thoughts on it? Or
yeah, I mean, I read some of it. I can't say I'm like a Jordan Peterson expert or anything like that. He, from what I've seen, I mean, that observation that our culture is like deeply suffused with Christianity is just a mere historical fact. What we make of that is a debate and is like a question that we should ask ourselves. From what I've read of him, and I think, you know, if you'd like to have that conversation, I'll probably need you to summarize some of his positions and,
sure.
and sort of help me understand that a little bit more, yeah. so that we can kind of get caught up. Because well, I don't think like it's not at hand for me, but what I've seen and what he's written is that for him, that means there's a kind of debt there. We need to embrace that. And there's something that's been lost. And that Christianity has, for instance, certain gender identities that are quite distinct, and that we are losing sight of that. And then he's also kind of arguing that there's like something fundamentally human in that, and that we're betraying something fundamentally human, and he kind of got slides between those two things. And so my anthropological training that simultaneously provincializes Christianity, but then recognizes its importance when I see where it predominates, rebels against that a little bit. Some of the things he says are like remind me a lot of like Joseph Campbell. So like sort of fundamental life path stuff. And some of that too, like I have a master's in anthropology. I started a PhD in that before I ended up switching more to religious studies. Just looking at the radical diversity in the history of human activity, it's like a little difficult for me to distill it down in that way. And so I think, I mean, he's obviously brilliant, right? And he was a scholar of like the Cold War. And of like propaganda and contributed great historical scholarship in that area before he became a more pop academic. And so I think that obviously he's going to be grounded in some strong empirical evidence, but from what, you know, just from what I've seen more recently, maybe less tightly empirically grounded in the way that like most working scholars who are passing through peer review would feel comfortable arguing.
Yeah. So to just to like, as you said, to bring up to speed. So in my phrasing, and I've seen other of his colleagues, other psychologists take him to task for the same thing, that my phrasing, he's fear-mongering. He actually says in his biblical series, and I'm quoting him verbatim, "We are abandoning the Judeo-Christian ethic at our peril." And one of the psychologists says, you know, according to Peterson's view, like the only option between either Christianity is despondent nihilism or totalitarian atrocities, which, you know, it just, and to me, he contradicts himself. He actually had, when I first came across the biblical series, I reached out to Steven Pinker, who had just written Enlightenment Now. And Pinker said, yeah, read my, I have a section on secularism. And so I was reading that. And then, in his series, like Peterson is, he's constantly, the sky is falling. And then he had Pinker on his own podcast, and in Peterson's own word, he goes, in study after study after study, the world is getting better. And I'm like, aha, so you're saying one thing to your biblical series audience, and you're saying the completely opposite thing to Steven Pinker, who knows, you know, if you're full of shit, you know, pardon my language. So, it just seems like, and you made the point about Campbell. I mean, that same thought occurred to me, that I remember in Joseph Campbell's series, The Power of Myth, Campbell was saying, like, that's why we're seeing like gang violence and things like this, because you sort of have these young men who don't have any grounding in myth anymore, and they're kind of lost. And so I sort of made that same connection between Campbell and Peterson as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a good assessment. He's responding to a crisis of masculinity by doubling down on certain ideas of masculinity and saying that this is going to fix it. And, you know, I get why that's an appealing message just to people who are struggling. But, we have so much good data at this point. The world is a laboratory. We have all of this. We've been collecting good data for a long time. We know some fundamental things. We know that household income is the best predictor of education outcome. We know that rates of crime are much higher where there's poverty. We know that if we do things like provide people affordable housing or access to affordable housing and healthcare, crime rates go down. You know, we know certain fundamental things at this point, and those are large, those are structural things. Those are policy things. Those are like, those are big levers, and we can't be putting everything on individuals and whether they're like have the right mindset toward the world. There's no way that like you're going to be, it's frustrating because like, you know, if you look at a particular economic system and the way in which a set of government policies, you know, partly statute, partly courts, partly Federal Reserve, something like that, the way they sort of lay out an economy, you have sizes of your strata. So you have like, you know, there's going to be a certain percentage of people who are like poor, certain percentage of people are rich, and you can pat yourself on the back about class mobility, but the size of those strata in a particular configuration, that's the reality. And so you can't have a nice fat set of poor people and say there's something wrong with poor people. That's not actually the case. And so that whole like put a Band-Aid on a gaping wound is I'm out on that. And so yeah, I think you're probably right. And generally that like that emphasis on personal responsibility is usually a sort of sad, ill-informed justification for abandoning people. And so yeah. I don't know how far you want to go down that, but obviously I have fairly strong opinions on dismissing people for what we say are their moral failings.
Yeah. Well, the other issue I take with Peterson is he equates atheism with psychopathy because he likes to, his go-to is Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and that, you know, Raskolnikov was an atheist who, and so he's redefined an atheist as not someone who just doesn't have a belief in God, but someone who has abandoned their belief in the divine spark within another person. And so he claims, and he was in a debate with Matt Dillahunty, and he was saying, well, you think you're an atheist, but you're really not, because you're acting out this Judeo-Christian ethic that you've been raised in, that, you know, you don't kill and rape and torture people. But I'm like, okay, well, that may have informed our laws. Like, we grow up in a society where, you know, you're taught human values and you have laws, and like the Judeo-Christianity is, as you said, like, it may be in the background, but it's hardly, you know, it's disingenuous to redefine atheism in that fashion. And I think as a clinical psychologist, and I will put myself out on a limb here, and if he wants to, he can charge me for slander, because this is verbal. I think it's professionally irresponsible of a clinical psychologist to equate atheism with psychopathy. And as you probably well know from your own research, like especially in the US, you know, atheists have this bad rep in the US that they're Satanists and baby eaters and all the tropes that we see. And there's such a negative image within the US, and Pew has done multiple surveys on that about like the negative view that a lot of the American religious people have of an atheist, that, you know, it's not that we don't believe in God, it's all we're Satanists and devil worshipers, which is kind of ironic because if we don't believe in God, we obviously don't believe in the devil either. So,
yeah, I think we can get into the history of it, and we can actually kind of bring it back around to explain why someone would have that misconception. And I think it really has to do with the secular paradox. And I briefly apologize, I'm getting over a cold, so you saw me mute a couple times and kind of cough, and I'll try to remain polite about my body overcoming me sometimes. So let's just break it down. In the history of atheism, there's this fascinating divide. Like, and I'm, you know, my poor PhD advisor had to deal with me going down this rabbit hole when I'm ostensibly a social scientist and an ethnographer, and giving the first chapter I gave her of my dissertation was on the history of atheism, and it was way too long, and she could tell that I was just working through questions, and I didn't even end up using that chapter. I pieced it out and published it elsewhere. But what I was looking for, I just couldn't understand. Okay, atheists today, I'm talking to people, they tend to believe the same things. They're actually a fairly specific set of beliefs. I can trace the institutions for centuries. There's all these secular religions that form in the wake of the French Revolution. Auguste Comte forms a religion of humanity in 19th century in France. We have ethical culture. That movement leads to the humanist movement. The first humanist manifesto published in 1933. They say explicitly we're religious humanists. There's this whole tradition. There's this whole tradition of being secular that we trace for hundreds of years. Probably trace it for longer than that. What is going on? So I started going back. And there's this divide among historians. And they're like, when they reach a certain point in the past, they're like, oh, how do we keep following atheism? Do we follow the heretics? And do we start to see people who are burned at the stake? Do we follow all the people who are called atheists? Or do we follow the stuff that modern atheists believe? Because in the late 1700s, that term atheism gets married to a positive set of beliefs when the French materialists become the first people to call themselves atheists. Atheism as a term has meant heretic for more than 2,000 years. Yeah. It's applied to all kinds of heretics. The early Christians called the Romans atheists, and the Romans called the early Christians atheists because they didn't believe in each other's gods. So atheism as a purely negative term, that's most of its history. When people start calling themselves atheists, things get much more confusing because you're taking a belief system that has variation within it. It's not a single belief system, so I should correct myself there. You're taking kind of a set of belief systems that share certain aspects and a debate going on among people, which is still going on today. Lots to disagree on among atheists, modern atheists. But you use this term that means heretic that's been passed through Christianity, so largely means Christian heretic. That's a paradox. That's largely where the secular paradox originates. It marries this hard negative to this, in fact, positive, and in doing so, it hides the positive that Jordan Peterson can't see. So I think it's interesting you go to Pinker, right? There's an Enlightenment tradition that's present that has its own values that are not necessarily what we call Judeo-Christian, even as sometimes Christians have those same values. So it gets complicated there a little bit. But there's a tradition there that you can trace. And for me, there was this aha moment fairly early on in graduate school when I was reading the extant letters of Epicurus. There's very few of this ancient Greek author, this atomist, yeah. who's written yeah, many, who wrote many volumes. Very little of it survived, which makes sense because Christians hate Epicureanism. And so yeah. in the early, there's this guy with this John DeWitt, wrote a couple books in 1954, beautiful books on Epicureans. One of them specifically focused on Paul and how much St. Paul hated Epicureans and in some ways built Christianity as a reaction to Epicureanism. So it's unsurprising then, and this is wild when I started to read this history. This is history that is done by Alan Charles Kors over four volumes. It took him 3 decades to write this stuff. It's very good. So he shows that atheism is developed by Christians as their own antithesis, because after the influence of Aristotle comes in through St. Thomas Aquinas, they really adopt this dialectical argumentative format in their theological treatises. And so they need an atheist or atheism to disagree with. So he has this beautiful phrase. He says, there's atheism before there's atheists, because there's atheism fully articulated in these arguments of Christian theologians before there are people who are like, ah, I am an atheist. Meanwhile, there are people being burned at the stake and killed in other ways for being atheists. It just means they're heretics. And so eventually the French materialists are like, wow, this stuff that Christians have been very interestingly defining for that's kind of us. And that's unsurprising too. Because when the Christians needed to invent an atheism, they didn't, invent it wholesale out of nothing. They actually largely went back to ancient Epicurean sources, occasionally some Stoic sources, a lot of skeptic sources. The ancient skeptic school is really hard to mesh with Christianity. And so they used these old sources that they found through the practice of Renaissance humanism to construct an atheism of the arguments, which they then opposed. And then eventually people were like, I think that people are onto something. And so there's this whole thing that we could think of as a belief system, a way of life, a set of bodily dispositions, an attitude toward the world that has this really deep history. It's changed a lot over the centuries. I'm kind of Epicurean, but I'm not an Epicurean, right? All this is transformed. But that's the hidden tradition, the subterranean current, as the French philosopher Louis Althusser calls it. that is this like sort of secular tradition that is negated by Christianity. And so Jordan Peterson can't see that. He thinks there's like Judeo-Christianity is just that they have like a some kind of monopoly on beliefs. But us secular people who say, oh, we're just the absence of that. We're merely a negative. We're just like, we're not those things. We contribute to that too. And so this is why I think it's so important to recognize the secular paradox and then recover a tradition for yourself, which is what I try to do in the fifth chapter, which is simply called tradition. Because that self-acknowledgement, it's very humbling at times, right? Like it throws us into this position where it's like, ooh, if I have a tradition, if I have a history, do I still have universal truth that I discovered through the means of science or through reason? Maybe that is a little bit in question when you're historically located. And that's been humbling for me. However, do I have a tradition? Absolutely. Is there a set of beliefs I can trace? Are there people who have been debating about those beliefs and values for centuries, if not millennia? Absolutely. Is Christianity this dominant hegemonic thing that makes my beliefs into its mere antithesis, its lack? Absolutely. And then when we call ourselves atheists today, it still has that valence of heretic. And so it's an inflammatory thing to identify as, to take up that mantle of heretic in the language of English and call yourself that. And so I don't agree that we should be mistrusted, which is a lot of what the research shows. Penny Edgell and some of her colleagues at the University of Minnesota have done a good job showing this over some articles that were first published in 2006, and then there's an update published later. This term atheist, heretic, right? It's like, it's troubling, but it hides something inside it. That negative hides something. And so I think this part of my career, this early part of my career, is very much about recovering the presence within atheism to argue with people like Jordan Peterson, but to help us argue better for ourselves as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So as I mentioned to you and some of our regular viewers might know, I'm also writing a book on the history of secularism. And one of the things I noted is, as you said, like this term atheist isn't often used to mean what it means today. It was a weaponized slur that directed at your opponent who just believes something different than you did. And you mentioned Epicurus. So what was really interesting, like reading the letters, I read the letters of Epicurus too. My writing style is always a bit weird. My first book and this book, I started in the middle. I started with Spinoza because the theological political treatise intrigued me. Like just the title alone captivated me, and because it was so influential on the Enlightenment. And so I started with Spinoza, which, you know, I wrote that chapter first. And then I went back. So each of my chapters is an era. So chapter one is classical antiquity. So I'm going back through classical antiquity, and I'm you know a couple of paragraphs on each people, and I get to Epicurus, and I start reading Epicurus's letters, and I'm like, hey, wait a minute, this is everything Spinoza's saying, like word for word, the cosmology, the mind body. It was just Epicurean through and through. And I Googled Spinoza and Epicurus, and just pure coincidence, that very month, Professor Vardalakis down in Australia had just released a book called Spinoza the Epicurean. So I reached out to him, he sent me a copy of his book, we had lots of back and forth conversations. And what got me is Stephen Nadler, who had written the biography of Spinoza. He's actually written quite a few books on Spinoza. And so I emailed Nadler, and he's like, yeah, no, Spinoza's Stoic. I'm like, no, this is Epicurean, completely Epicurean. So even Schopenhauer noted it. Jonathan Israel has noted it. So
yeah, Spinoza's hard to categorize in some ways. I agree with you. I just think it's interesting. I think he's a good synthesizer of various traditions. So he makes it hard on us by bringing things together. But like ethics, really, if anybody who's listening to this hasn't read Spinoza's Ethics, it's a fairly slim volume. It's really beautiful. It's really challenging, I think, as a text. But it cites very few things. And among the few things it cites is Lucretius's De Rerum Natura on the nature of things, which is the most complete Epicurus text we have of Epicurean thought. Yeah. It's in Latin, so it's a Roman text. But so Epicurus is the founder of a school known as Epicureanism, obviously. Interesting school. It accepts anybody, including slaves and women. And this is unusual at this time because a lot of the sort of Greek schools are really focused on really being available only to male citizens, free persons. And so they have these gardens where people can, they're oriented around these gardens, which are kind of these like communes, and they keep in touch with each other through letters. So that's why we have these extant letters of Epicurus. This guy, John DeWitt, when he's writing on Paul, argues that's where Paul gets the epistolary like idea to then keep in touch with the congregations, the Galatians, the Corinthians, right, et cetera, through the Epicurean model of keeping track of these people. So I'm just giving some background on ancient Epicureanism. So then Epicureanism is so influential that then there are Roman Epicurean schools as well. And Lucretius writes, basically the Christians thought it was such a beautiful poem that they kept copying it over the many centuries. And so Lucretius writes this beautiful poem. And then obviously Stephen Greenblatt has this book, The Swerve, which is the way it still imagines the Middle Ages as kind of a Dark Ages is completely wrong. There's some like historiographical things that are kind of off about the book, but there's a reason it won the Pulitzer Prize. So he tells this kind of hero story of this guy working in the Vatican court, the papal court, Poggio Bracciolini.
He was the papal secretary, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he goes around and he ends up finding like, this copy, I think it's in what's now Germany.
Of a
full copy of De Rerum Natura. And so then that is what ends up in the hands of Spinoza that influences him so deeply to write Ethics. And so I think what you and I are both doing right now is we're kind of tracing that tradition.
Yeah.
And we're saying there's a chain of citation and reference, but there are whole ways of life that go along with it. These aren't just text. These aren't just ideas. Like, I'm sure that you and I share some like physical attitudes and ways of being in the world because we share these beliefs and because we think of our lives in such similar ways. And so there's been a lot of people thinking about this. Now, were they always called atheists? Only if there's somebody to call them a heretic around. Were they talking about these ideas? Absolutely. Were they living according to them? Absolutely. What were they calling it? All different things, you know? Sometimes you're within Christianity and you think these things. Obviously, Spinoza is a heretic who was expelled from his congregation. You want to know something wild? So
yeah.
Samuel Beckett's like favorite thinker is this Calvinist theologian. The playwright Samuel Beckett is this Calvinist theologian, Arnold Glinks, who shows up in Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals as a kind of like whipping boy. But Glinks is brilliant. Glinks is in Leiden when Spinoza's writing Ethics, also writing a book called Ethics, which is itself a heretical book that's deeply influenced by atomism if you read it carefully. And they don't appear to have met or known each other, which seems impossible. So Glinks and Spinoza are both in Leiden in like 1679, writing books called Ethics. And they're thinking through these things. I mean, it's kind of an incredible coincidence. But yeah, there's a whole tradition there. And that tradition, as I would argue, is kind of our tradition. We should take ourselves seriously in that way so that the Jordan Petersons of the world can't tell us that we're in absence, we lack things, moral corruption arises from us. That's historically blind and easy and simplified and factually incorrect.
Yeah. I sort of have two sort of motivations for writing. One, I was reading Professor German McCulloch's book, A History of Christianity, and I thought, has anybody ever done for atheism sort of what he did for the history of Christianity and sort of documenting this? And there's things like the Oxford History of Atheism, but it's like $120, it's expensive, most of the general readers aren't going to read it. So I wanted to write a book for like the general public, like people, like the people in the skeptics in the pub drinking who just maybe want to know about this tradition. And the second is I love connections. Like there's even, it's sort of an homage to James Burke. Some of you may remember, I don't know, Joe, if you know it. He had a series, he's a British science historian. And in the 80s, he did a series called The Day the Universe Changed. And then in the 90s, he had a series called Connections, where he's literally doing connections. And that's sort of what I'm doing in the book. So I start, like I said, I start with classical antiquity, and then I show how Lucretius gets rediscovered and how that goes on to impact Machiavelli and Spinoza and the French and Jefferson and just tracing this tradition and connecting all the dots all the way through from classical antiquity up until, that the modern age that we're living in. So, and I thought, make it an easy, accessible read that, just your average guy in person sitting, your skeptics in the pub, they don't want to read some like highly technical paper from, some Oxford, obscure Oxford, really academic and out of the price range of most people. So
what's interesting, when I was doing that research, you get on these historical rabbit holes, and there's this term that I think only academics use, which is historiography, which is like the study of history. And so when you get into the kind of the meta level, the history of history, there's some really interesting texts. So there's this guy, Robert Porter Putnam, who writes a book, 400 Years of Free Thought, and it's published at the end of the 1800s. And it's kind of a biographical history. And he does this work too. It's an accessible book meant for everyday people that kind of traces this tradition. So it's a tradition that has been seen and remade over and over again by people attempting to hold on to it. And it doesn't mean that, I mean, I think we need to do this in every generation. This is how something stays alive. But it's really amazing to watch us go back and do it in every generation. And I think it's Pierre Gassendi who's the one who kind of tries to first trace in the early Enlightenment, the early modern period, the history of Epicureanism, and gets a lot of it wrong. Understandably, it's a difficult time to be writing a history because I can't, you know, I can Google things. And so there's this like long history of the histories as well. And I think that there's something true, I guess, I would say, in the consistency of our desire to reproduce that work. It means that we're all grasping for something and obviously need to grasp for it again and again. There's no such thing as a final statement on it. So to participate in that labor, I think is an important one. I agree. I participate in it as well.
Yeah. Okay. So just maybe last question as we wrap things up. So you alluded to it at the beginning of the conversation when introducing yourself. So what's it like to be an atheist teaching atheism in a religious studies department? That just sounds like an interesting story.
Yeah, it's so, you know, getting a job was hard because you're it's a tough sell. I think I'm kind of the atheism guy in religious studies. On a day-to-day level, it's awesome because I really landed a very good job because it's one of the only departments that could tolerate me in some ways. So we're a big department. We're the biggest department west of the Mississippi. We're one of the sort of historically important religious studies departments. Religious studies departments are so interesting, right? Like when my colleagues, especially on the STEM side of campus, encounter me and see that I'm in religious studies, I think the general assumptions is there's some kind of crypto theology going on here. And like, if I'm being totally honest, yeah, there sort of is, because I'm basically saying you can't just dismiss theological thinking. And there's a whole bunch of like understanding of what it is to be a human person thought under different circumstances in the history of theology. And it's not like we suddenly, you know, invent philosophy out of theology or something like that. And then this, right? So on some level, yeah, I'm probably more sympathetic to theology than a lot of my STEM colleagues, but they're wrong to have that kind of misperception. You know, what we do, especially at University of California, Santa Barbara, public university, is we study the object of religion in a very secular way. But the fact that we're a religious studies department is acknowledging that something is weird about religion, and you kind of need people who have special training to handle it because it's so different. Our understanding as professionals who do it, our understanding of religion is really weirdly different from everyday understandings. And so in my particular department, I fit really well. It's like, it's really nice. Obviously there's a lot of students on campus who are interested in taking a course on atheism. They understand like, that's me, you know, I want to know more about that. And occasionally there are evangelicals in the course who realize like, this is not at all what I thought it was. But it's true because, right? Because that course is a lot of what I've been telling you, which is, and what you're doing, it's giving it a history. It's giving it a positive presence. So the first thing I assigned them in that course is Epicurus's letters, because there's so few of them. They're so easy to read. Here, have them. And then we build over 2,000 years of history, the positive presence of atheism, while of course explaining how does it become a negative? Why does it become dismissed as a mere absence? How does that go on? And that's, it's beautiful work. It's beautiful work to introduce students to, even if they're evangelicals. And, you know, they're smart students too, and they reimagine themselves in different ways through that process. And so now, I think at the heart of your question is how to, like, in some ways, like, to be a religious studies scholar, to be perceived by strangers that way, to be in the broader field of religious studies. I don't know if you know anything about my field. Our big conference is called the American Academy of Religion. More than 10,000 people come to that annual conference. It is a mix of people. It is people coming from seminaries. It is people who are in brown robes with the top of their head shaved with a rope as a belt. And it's people who are priests wearing collars. And it's also people like me. And it's people who are just like amazing secular historians of the Pentecostal movement past century, right? So we're all mixed together. And that is the time when I feel, I think, the like the strangest creature to be the atheism guy in religious studies. And then hopefully, you know, there's more people who are able to carve out those niches. I think it's difficult, right? The job market's so tight. Are people going to hire somebody who's going to focus on secular things and atheism? I think we're kind of overdue. Departments need more of that because students are coming and they're being like, "Hey, I'm interested in religion, but I'm not religious. So how are you gonna understand what I am?" And I think we're not even to a point, unfortunately, where most scholars of religion and most people working in these areas really understand secular people to have a presence and have a history that's distinctive. But as they start to understand that more, perhaps we'll see more people working in religious studies. I should say, you know, one person who's also, he's not the atheism guy in religious studies, he's kind of the humanism guy in religious studies, is Anthony Pym. So he's kind of a humanist historian, a little bit of a humanist theologian. It's a bit of a contradiction in terms there, but he's at Rice and he does kind of more of that work. I think I'm the only person who really squarely studies atheism and studies it the way I do in religious studies. So it's a productively awkward fit, and it's a good fit for someone who wrote a book called The Secular Paradox.
Yeah. So you said you made me laugh when you said like the evangelicals come to the atheism class, that's not what they expect. So what were they expecting? Like to hear that, you know, we all like recipes for cooking babies? That's what, you know, how we're all demon worshippers.
No, so honestly, that class is small, and so it's hard to get into. You need to have a pastime that's fairly early, so it's mostly juniors and seniors, and it's a lot of students who have taken my courses before is who it ends up being. So it just structurally it ends up filtering a lot. So all of the students that I can think of who are evangelical who've taken it have already taken, say, like my big religion and politics class or another class for me, and so they kind of know my deal a little bit. They don't really know the history of atheism. But so the way they come to me is like, you know, you're going to see things a little differently, like going to stretch your brain a little bit. It's going to hurt a little bit. And they also know, you know, like one student in particular who I had a series of conversations with in my religion and politics class and then in my atheism class, you know, for her, there was a little bit of a crisis of faith with what we were studying. Yeah. So we had a conversation where I just said to her, you know, like, if you want, this doubt can strengthen your faith. And if you want, this can, you know, crack your faith open and you can become something else if you want. But that's not my place. And so I'm here to listen to you and make sure you have the resources, make sure you have things that you can read so that you can be who you want to be. My role is to help you understand enough of what is that you can actually take a step back and have some choice about what you want to be so that you're not just living a life that was handed to you by your parents or by the world. Yeah. How do I give you some distance that you can have some choice, but what you choose is up to you. So I think those can be really productive conversations. If it was a massive lecture on atheism and it just got a full fire hose of the random slice, right? I would probably have some unusual students in that class.
Yeah, I know I've heard Bart Ehrman say a number of times in his talks that his introduction to the New Testament is very confronting for a lot of the religious students who come in. I can see why. So, but which kind of puzzles me because, I mean, Bart Ehrman is such a famous New Testament scholar. You would think anybody taking his class should pretty much be understand what they're coming in for. But I guess maybe some of these kids have been sheltered in their high schools and they don't really know who he is and they just sign up for this class at the university. So.
Yeah. So. I mean, I would be surprised if any undergraduates read anything I write before signing up for one of my classes. It'd be very unusual. There are exceptions, but it's a pretty unusual thing. You know what's interesting too, just thinking about the field of religious studies, I have all these wonderful colleagues. They're very thoughtful people. I went to graduate school with all these interesting people. There's a whole subset of colleagues who are now liberal Christians, and we don't really exactly talk about what they believe, and you know, we're never going to have that conversation like, is God a metaphor for you or anything like that? I don't even know if they have it with themselves. And then people who are ex-evangelicals and atheists, they went to evangelical undergraduate colleges, started graduate training, learned Greek, learned Latin, know different kinds of Greek. Like one guy I know, he knows like Syriac, he knows like all these like really important biblical languages to be an early Christianity New Testament scholar. But is no longer, it was his evangelicalism that drove him to do all that. Yeah. But then he kind of quietly had this crisis of faith and became this stupendous scholar of early Christianity.
And so Ehrman, that's the same path Ehrman did. Ehrman had the same thing, went to Bible college and, you know, just get exposed to it. And he, you know, he talks about, like, you know, he's got a podcast just recently. He talk, says, yeah, I have colleagues who know all the New Testament history and they're still Christian. So, which, you know, that kind of baffles me too, like how you can know the history and still believe it. So,
believe is so tricky, right? It's so tricky. So the first chapter of my book's on belief and what exactly were you talking about with beliefs? Because I think within the history of Christianity, we think it's a propositional belief. So it's something we say that reflects a sincere interior commitment that we have. But belief's so much more complicated. Like we can say things and then not have that commitment. We can kind of say something else. We can want to be a part of community. I've had some interesting conversations with members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, where there's kind of a winking moment where they're kind of like, I agree with you on all of these things. And I'm like, cool. That's really good to hear. And then, but they're still members of the LDS Church because, you know, and then we'll have this kind of parallel conversation where it's like, and I just, you know, they really like what the culture of the church produces. They like the wholesomeness. They like their family. They like being part of other families who share a lot of the same values. They like the world that's created by their commitment to a certain set of beliefs, even if they do not, in fact, deeply hold those beliefs, which is, you know what I mean? People live those ways. And it, I think, you know, for them, it's like, this is, they're saying like, this works for me. This is what it does. It works.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, it's been about an hour now, so we'll wrap it up. So thank you very much for your time. It's probably a little more of an intellectual discussion than we normally have. I do tend to interview professors like you. You know, this is the second UC Santa Barbara prof in a row that we've interviewed. We had Harold Drake on last time talking about Constantine. So we do have a history of talking, you know, John Collins at Yale, but this was, I think, because the history of atheism is so fascinating, you know, in diving into Epicurus, you know, a lot of the people don't really know it. So it's probably been a little bit more of an intellectual atheist conversation than we normally have. But I hope our viewers who are into that found it useful. So I'd like to remind everyone to please like and subscribe. And Joe, thank you very much for giving us your time this morning.
Thanks, Jason. It's a pleasure.
All right. Take care, everybody, and we'll see everyone on the next episode. Bye-bye now.
Okay, thanks for listening, and don't forget we're on YouTube, so follow us on YouTube. Just search for Atheist Alliance International, and please subscribe and hit that notification bell. We're also on all of your favorite podcast platforms, so make sure that you follow us on there as well. See you next time.